Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Upton Sinclair's 1906 novel, The Jungle, chronicles a hardworking immigrant family seeking a better life. But brutal labor conditions and a corrupt political system bring desperation and death. The book was immensely influential at the time and remains a gripping story today. Joining me for this month's Reader's Review to talk about The Jungle and its contemporary relevance, Gardner Harris. He's science reporter for The New York Times. Peggy Ann Brown is writer and independent researcher. And Lisa Page is president of the Penn Faulkner Foundation and a creative writing teacher at George Washington University. The other day, somebody asked me for a recommendation for a book that would be relevant, up to date, and this is the book I recommended. Just a stunning, stunning novel. Gardner Harris, what do you think of it?
Well, I think you're right, Diane, in terms of there's obviously a lot of relevance to today. I mean, what struck me was how many things that Sinclair talks about that I've been writing about over the last 5 years. You know, the use of downer cows, he talks about, the use of all, you know, sick animals in the slaughterhouse. I mean, the sort of the sickness associated with it and all that. Of course, you know, right now there is a listeria outbreak going on in Colorado.
Cantaloupes.
In Cantaloupes, 13 people have died. I mean, as you know, we have talked about this on any number of programs, the food safety issues that continue to ripple across this country. And what's remarkable is how so many of those issues are sort of never ending. And of course, for Sinclair, his book really is about worker conditions. I mean, that's what he is focused on, the sort of the terrible toll that working in these slaughterhouses have. And of course, that hasn't changed either. I mean, you remember the Hormel meatpacking plant strike that went all on in Minnesota for, what, something like 10 years. And meatpacking continues to be one of the most difficult working environments in this country. So sort of on multiple levels, not only on the workplace level, but also on the food safety level, what Upton Sinclair describes. Now, obviously, it was even worse back then, but the issues that he talks about are very much relevant today.
Peggy Ann Brown, it is clear that what Upton Sinclair did was to go in undercover and himself work in these plants in order to create this unbelievably detailed and rich novel.
Well, Sinclair actually didn't work at the packing plants, but what he did do was for 7 weeks lived in Chicago and was able to go undetected into the plants and study conditions there. Because of his socialist connections, he also spoke with settlement house workers, lawyers, physicians, the workers themselves, and was able to get this elaborate picture of what was happening. His technique would be to dress as he was. He was had recently been in poverty himself, and so he looked like a poor man. He would go into the factories and study the conditions as he saw them, and then return back to his room where he was staying and write down everything that he had seen.
But how could he do that? I mean, was supervision so lax that he could simply wander those plants?
He did wander in, and he said that there were, when he didn't get a good understanding of a particular process, he would go back and wander time and time again through the room. By dressing in his overalls and carrying a dinner pail, he was able to blend in with the other workers.
And yet, Lisa Page, nobody wanted to publish this book.
Which is amazing. It's amazing to me. Well, of course they didn't want to publish it. It has so much information that people didn't want to get out. It's scandalous. It changed the law, yes, for meat, for the whole meat industry, sure, when it finally was published. It's also about the treatment of immigrants, Diane, and about class in Chicago, but throughout the country, frankly, the exploitation of workers. It's multifaceted and complicated and difficult.
Our hero, Yurga, comes to this country with his family, truly seeking a better life for his then fiance. But isn't it interesting that this novel opens with this glorious wedding taking place, this wedding that has everybody joyously participating, but we learn toward the end of the chapter that at the time, guests were expected to contribute, and they hardly got a dime.
Right. Right.
So they start out in poverty.
Right, but I mean, I think what's difficult for me anyway about reading this book is that it, you know, the book really starts at sort of a high note, this celebratory wedding celebration and everybody having a great time. And then just chapter after chapter, you get body blow after body blow of the various disasters that befall this family. And I think also what is particularly difficult for me was, you know, yes, this is about the difficulties faced by immigrants. But, you know, I think I seem to remember from much of my American history that I mean, most of those European immigrants were coming from truly disastrous situations. I mean, the sort of the pogroms that were going on in Eastern Europe and elsewhere were hell on earth. And so even in some of these fairly bad conditions in the United States, many of those conditions absolutely terrible. But for many of these families coming from places in you know, London was certainly no better, and neither were some of the shtetls and the ghettos in Europe. So I think many of the immigrants came, you know, inured to terrible conditions. And of course, what is unusual about Sinclair's character is that they actually were relatively well off, the sort of petty bourgeois. Jurgis's family had lived in a bucolic setting in the midst of a beautiful park and had a very good life, which of course makes the contrast to his situation in once he arrives in the United States that much more stark.
I want to talk about the title of this book, The Jungle, because in this Oxford World Classics version, there's a key paragraph left out. I don't know why, but Peggy Ann, would you read that paragraph for
us? Yes, I just wanted to make one comment first. The book was called The Jungle when it was published in The Appeal to Reason. When finally Doubleday had agreed to publish it, they actually asked Sinclair to change the title, and he didn't want to. But they said, well, if you won't change the title, at least we want you to take out some of the references to the jungle. And that's what he did. And this is an example of it. This is when the family is first coming to Chicago. And this is a sentences that are left out of the Oxford edition. To the strangers, it seemed like a wilderness, a very jungle, a jungle of houses. It was a jungle, too, ruled by strange powers about which they did not understand, full of creatures which preyed upon each other. They were hunting you without rest, tracking you in the daytime and watching in your path by night. The only difference was that they sought not your lifeblood, but your money. And when you had been caught by them once or twice, you came to understand that this difference was no difference at all.
You see, it's the people who are part of that jungle of individuals being preyed upon. It is the animals who are preyed upon. It is the very society in its class system where those up above prey on those below.
I think it's interesting that in the metaphors that are used to describe, particularly Jurgis, that you do get this animal metaphors. He's like a steer that's gotten loose in the factory. He's a buffalo roaming around in his wildness. So there's that imagery, but there's also the imagery of the people being the cogs in the machines, being able to be the replaceable parts. When they get ill because it's unskilled labor, just a tiny little bit, they're able to be quickly taken out and replaced.
Here's a message from Kate, who says she grew up in Chicago, that people are still hush-hush about slaughterhouses there, because jobs were lost after this book, The Jungle, came out.
Right. Well, you know, Diane, in many ways, I'm a failed muckraker. You know this. You've known me for a long time. And I, of course, spent a long time in the coal fields of eastern Kentucky and went in a lot of mines. I wrote investigative stories about it. I wrote even a novel about it. And that same sort of code of silence, of course, happens today, to this day, in the coal fields. I mean, we saw this in the disaster 2 years ago. In the wake of that disaster, almost no one in the mine, you know, spoke to reporters or spoke to the inspectors. And then over the course of the 4 or 5 or 6 months after the disaster, when people finally realized that they either could not go back to the mine or would not, they finally began to open up about the terrible conditions there. And that sort of code of silence happens in the coal mine community right now. I mean, most, in my experience in eastern Kentucky, most of those mines do not run particularly safe on a day-to-day basis. And the coal miners go along with those conditions because they feel that if they do not, they will lose their jobs.
And you still have sweatshops going on in this country with many, many people jammed into single rooms producing goods. We'll take a short break here. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Welcome back. Our book for our monthly reader's review is Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. I hope you'll join us, 800-433-8850. Earlier, you heard Peggy Ann Brown read a paragraph that has been, I don't know what to say, deliberately left out, thrown out, disregarded from the Oxford World Classic that all of us read. Peggy Ann, talk about what else got left out.
Well, the edition that we're reading, the Oxford edition, is actually the 1906 Doubleday edition, and that's the one that's been published since that time and the one that everyone would be familiar with. When Sinclair first wrote the novel, he wrote it as a serial for the Socialist Weekly, The Appeal to Reason. And that version actually was 30,000 words longer than this Doubleday version.
Paid by the word, I'm sure. Just like Charles Dickens.
Actually, he got a flat rate of $500.
Oh, he did.
To write the novel. But when Doubleday agreed, and this was after Macmillan had turned down the novel and five other publishers had turned down the novel, they said, take out the blood and guts. And so the novel in its original form was even worse than what we've read today.
And we've got lots of blood and guts in here.
Absolutely. But the thing that's more curious is actually that that Sinclair cut some sections of the novel that would have made the reader more sympathetic toward the characters. And I can give you one example. In the novel, Stanislovis, Ona's brother, becomes very frightened of the cold when he sees another boy in the lard room has his ears break off because they're frostbitten. In the original, it's just cuts off like that in the Doubleday version. The ears were rubbed off. In the Appeal to Reason version, it says the ears fell off. The young boy falls on the floor, writhing in pain. Just the addition of that, that's what the reader is left with, this image of this poor boy on the floor, whereas in this version, all we have is the picture of the ears on the floor.
But has anyone since 1906 published the unexpurgated version?
There have been two editions when it was published. It was published in 1988. Which is the Appeal to Reason version. And it's a kind of an interesting story. It seemed to have been lost to history. And a construction worker went to Pittsburgh State University in Kansas and said, we've found these manuscripts in this old house. And a special collections librarian took them, and it took him 8 years to go through them and remove the mold, and he had the version from the Appeal to Reason. Then in 2003, which is the version that I read from, which was from a publication called One Hoss Philosophy, which was owned by the same publisher who did Appeal to Reason. It was a quarterly publication at the time. And so this edition is drawn from that version.
But the one that most people see in the bookstores is this original.
The 1906 Doubleday version.
The 1906.
It's the director's cut Peggy is talking about.
The director's cut.
And isn't this the way, Diane? I mean, those darn editors will always get you.
Yeah. So there are different versions of this story, but it is, in whatever form you read it, a very, very powerful story. Before Yerkes gets his job in the meatpacking plant, he gets a tour of the plant, and he's very impressed, Lisa.
And excited. He's thrilled to be there. He sees the economy of the situation. He sees how hard everyone's working. The speeding up even gets him excited. He's like, I can do this. I'm strong. And he is, at that point of the book, strong enough for that work. But that goes away.
That goes away because they quickly realize that everyone in the family is going to have to work because they have been lured into buying a house,
right?
I mean, which is said to be new.
Right. I mean, again, you sort of get echoes of the crisis going on in housing right now with the liar's loans and
Hello.
And all the rest with obviously tens of thousands of people right now losing their homes. And so they get suckered in, even though they get opinions from two lawyers who seemingly are independent that this is all right. But of course, they do not realize that they not only have to pay the $12 a month that to sort of pay for rent, but they're going to have to then start paying interest, and there are all sorts of taxes. And
it's supposed to be a brand new house.
Right, which, of course, is already 15 years old at that point.
And painted over and over and just repaired in a ramshackle fashion.
And it has a cesspool underneath it for all of the drainage of all of the people that have lived there that is collected.
Right. So it's and of course, you know, in one of the many body blows that ends up hitting Yerkes, you know, the street outside is not paved, and his toddler, 18-month-old son, about 2/3 of the book, ends up falling into the mud and drowning as sort of the last you know, body blow that strikes Jurgis in the sort of the first portion of the book that we were talking earlier, and Peggy was talking about how Sinclair actually was interested in making two books. And there is sort of an extraordinary break
after
the death of his child.
And
of his wife, of course.
You know, the thing that interested me was that he, Jurgis, goes almost nuts because he learns that his wife has been seduced by one of the bosses, and seduced for money.
Right, I don't think seduction is quite the word, but is forced to have sex with the boss.
Well, okay, yeah. All right, forced to have sex for money that she believes she's got to contribute to the upkeep of the household.
I'm not sure that actually it's for money more than to be able to keep her position,
her job, yeah.
Because he also threatens her that he knows the bosses of everyone else in the family.
So Jurgis goes nuts and goes
absolutely
after the guy, and then the system kicks in.
Well, and he loses his job, and he goes to jail, and the family loses their jobs, and they lose their house, and it all collapses
apart.
And that same boss stays in power. His name is Connor Riley. And eventually Jurgis meets him later and
yeah,
beats
exactly
him up again.
Has become by then a power in the
Mike
sort
Scully's
of the Irish mafia.
Right.
But the point being that he prevents Jurgis from getting any job anywhere.
He's blacklisted.
Right.
He's blacklisted. Now, there's an email there, Lisa, that you might want to read, and let's get some opinions on this.
Diane, when I was in high school in the 1960s, my American history teacher recommended The Jungle. It wasn't required, and for some reason, I actually read it. It helped to radicalize me. Not that I thought that the U.S. in the 60s was the same as the U.S. in 1906, but injustice was still injustice, and it continued to be institutionalized in so many ways in our country. In later years, I read more of the radical writings of Upton Sinclair and Jack London. It was wonderful. Recently, however, I listened to The Jungle as an audiobook version on a long trip. It was still excellent, but I was surprised at some of the racist elements in the book. It is chapter 26, as I recall, which profiles the strike-breaking at the meat processing plant, strike-breaking by African Americans. Now, such events took place many times and across different working situations in our history, making cooperation between white and black workers difficult, but the way that Upton Sinclair profiled this sort of event was shocking. These African Americans, sheltered behind the factory gates day and night, are pictured as dancing around bonfires through the night like so many primitive peoples, also drinking and cavorting, inviting loose white women to join them in their beastly behavior. Hey, these are almost word for word taken from Upton Sinclair's own descriptions, and you could have knocked me over with a feather. I suppose his writings were indicative of the times and should be appreciated as such, but even in context, it's good to remember that he was a leftist radical. Perhaps I expected better. Paul.
It's interesting. From Paul, what's your reaction?
I agree with you that those descriptions are horrible. On the other hand, and this doesn't make them acceptable, he was the middle-class reformer. Other middle-class reformers had the same nativism, racism, and expressed it. He was also a Southerner. And I think that doesn't forgive it, but perhaps explains it a little. The images are horrible, and I don't believe that the workers were dancing around in the factories. There is documentation that there was a lot of death and disease during the strike because the people were living inside the factories in very close conditions. And why he doesn't bring that more out and has these horrible caricatures, it's unclear, other than to say that just a middle-class reformer of the time period, that's how they
talked remember, about this was the time of, obviously, Teddy Roosevelt. And, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was the first president to have dinner with a black man at the White House, and it happened right at this time, and it caused a national scandal that Teddy Roosevelt would do this. And Teddy Roosevelt and threatened his reelection prospects. It was such a terrible scene, is such a terrible thing across the country that he never did it again. And, you know, that sort of racism was absolutely so common across the country.
Let's open the phones. We'll go first to Limestone, Tennessee. Good morning, Eric. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just have to wonder what your thoughts are on how much has changed in industry. If this book hadn't have been published, we likely wouldn't have the FDA. How much has actually changed in industry in the way that they treat workers basically like a commodity? Like in the book, they treat them pretty much as the animals that they're slaughtering.
Gardner.
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I mean, I think, you know, let's be fair. There are just enormous reforms that have come up since then. I think the workers' comp system is probably, you know, which is a nationwide system, is probably the sort of the most important, because, you know, what happens to Jurgis and what happens to everybody else in the factory is that this, you know, he sprains his ankle at one point and he is out of work for 2 months, and it all but destroys the family. I think you would be hard pressed to find, certainly there. The New York Times had a Pulitzer Prize-winning series a few years ago about these pipe-fitting companies that had by far the worst workers' comp records in the country, where people were getting killed and injured. That I think that level of injury and death, I think you would, it just does not happen at this point.
But would the FDA have been created it not been for this?
Well, that's also sort of under dispute by historians. I mean, obviously there was, I mean, Upton Sinclair was not the first or even the only muckraker of the day. There was considerable push toward the Pure Food Drug Act of 1906. He helped sort of push that reform enormously, but it probably would have happened without him.
Gardner Harris of the New York Times. He's also author of the mystery novel Hazard. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Lisa.
Yeah, I want to sort of take issue with you here
Please.
Little bit, because there was a book about tomatoes out this year, about immigrants working in tomatoes in Florida. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the book or the writer, but the immigrants there were horribly exploited. There are problems with pesticides.
Absolutely.
It's very comparable to what's happening here. Am I...
I think, I mean, I certainly think that certainly, you know, with the in some of the fruit picking and in the vegetable processing, because largely those workers are illegal immigrants at this point. They're sort of their legal status is sort of always in jeopardy. They tend not to complain. And I think that there has been some pretty good journalism and some investigations about the working conditions in those plants. And oddly enough, you know, one of the big pushes towards improving those conditions is actually coming from the FDA, because what has gone on is that you have poor sanitation on the part of the workers. They don't have any facilities to go to the bathroom. So that then they end up passing on E. coli onto the plants themselves. And so,
and that seems to be perhaps what happened in this latest outbreak
of
with
cantaloupes.
The cantaloupes.
Exactly. So it's a constant problem. But there are pushes to sort of address it. And I'm not saying that these problems have disappeared, but
no.
The sort of jungle-like atmosphere that sort of pervades all of Chicago, I think, you know, for a fair-minded person, you would be hard-pressed to sort of find those conditions, you know, throughout an area.
All right. Peggy Ann, you wanted to add something.
I was just going to say that while there were a number of investigators looking into aspects of Pure Food and Drug Act, I think that Sinclair's novel was successful in giving that final nudge
right.
That Roosevelt said he was getting so much correspondence from his constituents who were saying, you have to look into this. And he did send two investigators after The Jungle was published to Chicago to look into it. And they said, actually, that parts of the novel were understated.
Right,
what
right.
about the creation of the union movement here?
Sinclair really doesn't talk much about the unions in the novel. He was not a big union supporter. And so I think that was one aspect that probably should have come out more in the novel and doesn't.
Right. His character, Jurgis, was a strikebreaker, you know.
Right.
Oddly
in the
enough.
End,
yes.
he,
but again, for money.
Exactly.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly. Let's go to Sterling, Virginia. Very quickly, Gary, you're on the air.
I rode on a train with 10 meat packers, and they all didn't want to talk about the killing room, and they all agreed that if they had a room where all the cattle could be moved into and the oxygen pumped out and soft music played to them and the cattle went to sleep, and then they could go in and slaughter them. I told them also a village, El Valle, in the Republic of Panama, was famous for their chicken. And what it was, they used to give the chicken a tablespoon of wine, it'd go to sleep, and then they'd kill it.
You know, it's interesting because people like Temple Grandin, who has autism in her history and background, came up with this whole idea of how to mercifully do away with the cattle as opposed to slaughtering them in the way they clearly do in this book. We've got to take a short break. Gary, thanks for your call. When we come back, we'll go to Orlando, Florida, North Carolina, Texas, and Ohio.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sand and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. And by Novo Nordisk, for nearly 90 years committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. This is NPR.
When comedy writer Will Reiser had cancer, he and his friend Seth Rogen amused themselves with ideas for ridiculous cancer comedies.
We wanted to do like a parody of The Bucket List, where you do like really absurd, ridiculous things like, you know, skydiving with hookers.
Reiser did write a cancer comedy, 50-50. Reiser and the film star Joseph Gordon-Levitt on the next Fresh Air.
And here's an email as we talk about Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle. It's from Mac, who says, this show so far is giving the same narrow treatment to The Jungle that it received at the time the book was originally published. Sinclair was seeking to promote a general democratic socialism in America and overturning of the corporate hegemony of his time. Instead, the public and the corporate-controlled press of that time got all upset about the very limited issue of food contamination and created better safety laws. Sinclair famously said, quote, "I aimed for America's heart, but I hit its stomach." Yeah. Peggy Ann.
This was a quote that Sinclair said over and over, and Mac's absolutely correct. Sinclair felt that by presenting the facts, people would understand that socialism was the way out of all these problems. At the same time, Sinclair admitted to Macmillan and Doubleday that the book should have been put into two separate parts, that the second half was not successful in communicating to the readers why socialism would be the way out.
Do you think that that's why so many people have gotten focused on the one issue and not the broad issue?
I think that, and also the fact that those images are so startling, you can't help but focus on them. But also, just as I said before, that the fact that he took out some of the more empathetic sections of the book, that the middle class reader who was reading this book, all they could think about were their own concerns about food, and they couldn't identify at all with the characters and what was happening to them.
All right, let's go to Centerville, Ohio. Good morning, James. You're on the air.
Yes. What concerns me and really alarms me, especially of late and ties in with this book, is how especially politicians and particularly Republicans seem to stress how important it is that we not do anything, especially raise taxes, that will in any way hurt or cause problems with the wealthy that, quote, create jobs. And no one talks about the worker. And no matter how many people there are that invest money to create jobs, without the worker, you know, nothing will get done. And we do nothing to uplift the worker in our country, even still today. Forget about 1906. Now, Ayn Rand in her book, where all of the wealthy and the inventors leave and say, well, what will happen to society if we're not around? Let's leave and see what happens. How about if all of the workers were to leave, the ones that create the proverbial widgets, and there were no widgets left? I mean, the worker is so key to our society, but yet no one talks about the worker and what's needed to help them. It's always those who create the jobs.
Lisa.
Well, I agree with that statement. I also think that the other people who are not talked about very much in the press are the poor. Whether they're the working poor or they're not working, they're getting ignored. And there are reports today from Chicago of young children on the South Side coming to school unwashed because they don't have running water in their homes. Those are real stories happening in America that we don't want to look at. We want to look at other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think every one of the bad guys in this book would be called a job creator today.
Yeah,
you know, Diane, I think. And it's obviously a very different ethic that Upton Sinclair has. And of course, even the very definition of what socialism is has changed dramatically. When people term Barack Obama a socialist, I think Upton Sinclair would not recognize the term. So the political spectrum obviously has shifted enormously.
I want to ask you all about the second half of this book, because it seems so out of sync with the first half of the book, in that Jurgis loses his mind, in effect, and runs out to the country, sleeps wherever he can find, and then he encounters one of Chicago's wealthiest sons and stays with him for... It didn't make any sense to me, did it to you? What was Sinclair doing there?
I think that the second half of the book very clearly matches with some of the problems Sinclair was having in his own life. And he said that he was bothered by problems with his ill wife and his ill son, and that he poured a lot of the emotion from that experience into the novel. When he was telling Macmillan that he wanted to separate the book into two halves, he said, I need to do more research. I need to go back. I need to find out about the politics of Chicago. And so it was obvious that he did not have this section as well researched. He's trying to show the contrast with Freddie Jones, with Jurgis, but he's not successful in making that mean anything.
No.
Well, Lisa probably knows this better than I, because you're as head of Penn Faulkner. I mean, but my sense in writing myself is that, you know, that middle third of the book is, when you write a book, is by far the most challenging. It's relatively easy to set up your characters and set up your problems. And then, you know, your resolution you sort of have in mind, but sort of getting from your setup to your resolution is sort of the meat of the book, and mm-hmm. and can be so difficult where all the strains have to sort of braid together. And I really got the sense that in reading this, that Upton Sinclair hadn't really figured out how to make the braid.
I think that's right, and I'm so impressed with what you've been saying about that. Meant this to be two books, because it felt like that to me.
Right.
The other dynamic, when you talk about literature and its structure, that struck me about the book is you have the conflict, the conflict, the conflict, no resolution.
Right.
Conflict,
right.
Conflict,
right.
No resolution. Until the end, and then you've got socialism.
Whoa.
Right, in a pages long speech.
Exactly.
You know,
it
fairly
doesn't work,
unsatisfying.
Really.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's the criminal element in Chicago that he even becomes involved in.
And the political machine.
Which
is still there, even with Mr. Emanuel.
There's another thing we didn't even talk about, that, you know, how it's present today, and they're talking about paying people to vote, and, you know, sort of all the what
Absolutely.
Chicago has long been famous for.
And dead people voting.
Corruption. Yes.
Vote early and vote many times.
Exactly. And some people literally voted many times. What was the public reaction when the book first came out?
Well, the reaction was to the images of how their food was being prepared. Everyone became vegetarians for a while. They were worried about what was going into their foodstuffs. They were able to, this was the final nudge to get that Pure Food and Drug Act passed
but
in June.
But was it a bestseller?
It was a bestseller.
It was.
It was. Within, I think it was 6 weeks, it had sold 25,000 copies. Doubleday was approached by a staff member from Armour who tried to bribe him.
A meat packer.
A meat packer. Armour's a meat packer. And he was so offended by this because he said, why don't you kind of cut back on the publicity and don't publish it in Europe? And Doubleday was so offended by this that within the year, it was translated to 17 languages and became a sensation in Europe also.
Interesting. Let's go to Arlington, Texas. Good morning, Ed.
Hi. So am I correct in understanding that the most commonly available versions of this book are incomplete? Typically, when I want to read a serious work of literature, I consult Norton Critical Editions or the Modern Library. I was under the impression that they would probably have produced a reliable copy of this book. Are you saying that those versions would be incomplete? And if so,
no, they're not incomplete. The version that's available is the 1906 Doubleday version that Sinclair approved, but the original version that appealed into the Appeal to Reason, the Socialist Weekly, and in One Hoss Philosophy include the sections that he cut out for the Doubleday version.
Where can one get that?
I don't think that the 1988 version is available anymore. It was not well publicized and is no longer in print. The edition that was from One Hoss Philosophy is published by C Sharp Press, and it's called The Jungle, the Uncensored Original Edition. And I believe that this is still available. It came out in 2003.
And okay. do you think that might be available on Amazon?
I think that it might be. I'm not positive
good.
About that.
Well, give a good look for it, Ed. I'm with you. Let's go to Stewieville, Utah. Good morning, Shauna.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment from
some remarks of a previous caller who said something to the effect of nobody is thinking this day of the workers. We always want to think of the people who are the job creators. And I would just point out that it were because of labor unions and workers that a lot of these safety reforms and regulations were actually put into place under the safety of a union, an organized union. Many workers were able to stand up to employers and actually refuse to go into unsafe conditions and still keep their jobs and not have the fear of losing their livelihood. And I think that labor unions play a huge part in all of this, and they have. At the time that this was going on, there was a rise in labor unions. And I would propose that perhaps we maybe take a look at the correlation between the decline of labor unions in our today's workplace and what's happening in the workplace and safety conditions, as well as the other regulations that have come into play with this. And I know I have a bad connection, so I'll take any comments off.
All right, Jonah, thanks for calling.
Well, that's right. I mean, right now there is a huge debate going on in this country about regulations, government regulations. And, you know, many of the Republican candidates for president believe and are saying that regulations are choking the economy of the United States. It is regulations, though, that basically have created the environment that save people's lives on a day-to-day basis. It's the regulations in coal mines that they were just, you know, reformed again 2 years ago in the wake of yet another disaster. It's the regulations in construction sites. Silicosis was once at very high levels in this country. Silicosis is something that can kill you very quickly through a sort of an emphysema-like reaction where your lungs get cut as if they were ground in glass. There are countless workplace injuries that are less common and are not present at all because of these sort of regulations. I think that people sort of tend to forget the sort of the upside of regulations.
Gardner Harris of the New York Times. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Winter Garden, Florida. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Diane. I love the show.
Thank you.
And I wanted to maybe ask, have your panel talk about contemporary muckraking with regards to film and television. I'm specifically thinking about the PBS documentary Banks of the Poor, the exposed redlining, or Frederick Wiseman's Tittycuff Follies, which exposed the Boston mental health system. And has film and television, obviously it's been an impact on the muckraker's job, but what specific comments maybe do your panel have? Is making it easier, making it more difficult?
Lisa.
Well, I think that it's a great time that we have a documentary like Food, Inc. that breaks down what's happening today with the beef industry. The other film about Fast Food Nation.
Right.
And then there was the, all of these films have, I think, moved the discussion forward and made people a lot more aware of what's happening. And I think that's good news.
Right. Some of the original muckraking work was obviously in mental health institutions. I mean, they began in the 1870s and 1880s. And what's remarkable is just how what a wellspring that sort of muckraking has been. I mean, they continued through the 60s and 70s. Who am I thinking of? The famous TV journalist with the mustache who sort of established themselves in New York by a famous insider look at sort of the mental health institutions, you know.
Are you talking about 60 Minutes?
No, no.
Gerald?
Yeah, Geraldo.
Geraldo
Rivera. I mean, he yes. made his bones by yet another sort of muckraking thing on a mental health thing. And the Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize, I want to say, 4 or 5 years ago, exposing problems in dealing with children with mental disabilities in Washington, D.C. I mean, I think this stuff goes on and hopefully will continue to go on forever. I'm at the New York Times. We have a very strong investigative unit. It is harder to sort of become employed in some of these places. We have rules against lying. You know, some of the underground sort of video, which oddly now, of course, is coming out sometimes even on the Republican side. Obviously, you're having some video semi-journalists and political activists against Acorn and some of these other places. So this is a lively area that continues.
But Mike in Keller, Texas, points out that we mentioned that Sinclair researched the jungle by wandering around in packing plants. Try doing that anywhere now,
right,
near a modern food production facility. Michael Pollan has noted it's difficult even to photograph the exterior of a factory farm. One may as well forget about documenting any details of their operation.
Right. Infamously, Oprah was sued when she
talked badly about hamburgers.
Exactly.
But the other thing is that investigative journalists are fewer and farther between.
They are, unfortunately.
So. Because newspapers are not putting the money.
Are dying.
Right. Exactly.
I'm sorry, but my industry is going down the tubes.
What did you say? Yeah.
Well, I think we were talking about this last night at a small dinner party. I do believe that while a great many people are going to turn to online reading, the New York Times, however small, is going to be with us.
I certainly hope so.
I do,
I'm
too.
Hanging on with my with my bare hands here, Diane.
All right, Gardner Harris. He's also a novelist. It's titled Hazard, but his day job is a science reporter for the New York Times. Peggy Ann Brown is a writer and independent researcher. Lisa Page is president of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, creative writing teacher at George Washington University. And next month, on October 26th, we're going to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the book Children and Adults Adore Peter Pan.
Wow.
So I hope you'll be with us. Thanks for listening. All the book we've been talking about, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle.